Atlanta Athletic Club, a history, written by Charles Eliot in 1973. Forward. This is the year of our Lord, 1973. Your Atlanta Athletic Club is 75 years young as of the publication of this volume. Three quarters of a century is well within the lifespan of many men. Yet what we call civilized progress has taken some giant strides in those years since 1898. Man is a regular traveler in space, and Americans have walked on the moon. Medicine has found a cure for almost every human affliction, except the common cold and cancer. And yet, man is well on the way to polluting himself out of existence. In that span of a single lifetime, he has come from the horse and buggy days to supersonic transport jets that whisk him around the earth in a matter of hours. Look back for a moment at the last half of that decade in which AAC was born. Many of the momentous events that shaped our destiny then are dust and ashes today, even though they laid the foundation for what we are wont to call our modern world. In February of 1898, the U.S. battleship Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor, and 2 months later we went to war with Spain. The Spanish-American conflict didn't last too long, less than 4 months, but out of it, the United States emerged as a world sea power. The first gasoline-powered automobile was 11 years old, and another model operated by steam had been on the market for 9 years. The electric auto came into existence in 1892, and there was some question as to which of the three vehicles would survive as the popular and common carrier, or whether the horse was here to stay. This was 5 years before Henry Ford organized the Ford Motor Company, or the Wright brothers made their first airplane flight of 120 feet in 12 seconds at Kitty Hawk on the North Carolina coast. Atlanta was a city powered by horses and horse-drawn vehicles. 1898, only 5 years before, Thomas Edison had given the first public showing of his kinetoscope, which was the progenitor of the movie camera and, of course, of the vast present cinema empire. Marconi had received his wireless patent from Great Britain only a couple of years before, and in 1898 was still years away from sending his first transcontinental signal winging through space between Cornwall, England, and Newfoundland. No one but the science fiction writers dared to come up with such outlandish predictions that someday the human voice would travel the airways around the Earth, and anyone suggesting the medium we know today as television, bouncing from one end of the world to another via satellite, most certainly would have talked his way into a padded cell. William McKinley was president of the United States and was assassinated in 1901 to be succeeded by Teddy Roosevelt, one of the most colorful of our presidents. The gramophone, great-great-great-granddaddy of the stereo, was 2 years old, and Kodak by Eastman was but a cave model of our photographic equipment as we know it today. Edison's incandescent lamp was only beginning to replace oil-burning lamps and candles. The Georgia Power Company had so few customers that Preston Arkwright, longtime member of the club, who was bookkeeper and later president of Georgia Power, made out the power bills by pen each month and personally delivered each one. Our affections lay then with the family garden, instead of fresh frozen foods and other fancy packaged wares in the supermarket. Coca-Cola was not a household word throughout the world, but a syrup poured out of a gallon jug and stirred into a glass of water at a few local soda fountains. It was under what we now consider as those primitive conditions that AAC came into existence, as a means of enticing its members away from the, quote, easy living of the times, to a more rigorous physical schedule which promised restoration of vitality and healthfulness, which seemed to a number of young Atlantans of that period to be slipping away from Americans in general at an alarming pace. Chapter 1. No one knows with whom the idea originated, how long it was tossed back and forth over luncheon tables or around the tennis courts and public swimming places, or whether it had been conceived at all before August 1898. During that month, 65 young businessmen of Atlanta met to discuss what they considered a pressing, if not altogether serious, problem. No one remembers who did the necessary legwork to get them together, but all were concerned with one principal objective. The businessman of 1898 was plagued with many of the same problems which face both the young and old executives of today. One of these was the arduous mental effort of trying to run a business for profit instead of loss. And sometimes this left little room for play or for physical exercise of any kind. Those men who met in August, three quarters of a century ago, were well aware that one of the most important basic requirements of an active and alert mind is a sound physical body. Most of them were already prominent in the growing industrial world of Atlanta and the region, and over the next half century or more, many were to leave their monuments in buildings, parks, streets, and subdivisions, and in financial and other institutions. On that day in August, however, they met for a common purpose: to find some place which could provide both the accommodations and the incentive for them to get together and play tennis, which was the popular game of the times, or exercise regularly with the barbells, Indian clubs, and other gymnasium equipment. This meeting, however, had implications far more reaching than perhaps any of those who were involved had realized, for out of the discussions developed the idea of a combined exercise and social club that the founders agreed to call the Atlanta Athletic Club. The petition for a charter was drawn up by Burton Smith as attorney for the group, and the Atlanta Athletic Club was born. Not wasting any time, a committee of the charter members drew up the first constitution with the objectives, quote, to promote health by exercise and to encourage manly sports and social relations among its members. Bylaws adopted in those early years limited a man's credit with the club to $10, and this had to be paid within 30 days, or a member was suspended from the privileges of the club, and if he had not settled in another 30 days, he could be expelled by a vote of the board. The earliest set of house rules the club historian was able to locate were generally indicative of the times, and at least some of these rules may be of interest to the modern members of AAC. For example, the club must be closed in all departments by 11:45 p.m. The steward has no discretion in this matter. Or playing cards or throwing dice for supplies is prohibited. The shining of shoes is permitted only in the dressing room. Dogs will not be allowed in any part of the club building. No member shall bring into the clubhouse a gentleman who has previously been expelled from the club or a visitor who is under the influence of whiskey. A fine of $50 will be imposed upon any member staying or sleeping in the clubhouse after it is closed and locked for the night. Members are not allowed behind the counter in the buffet. No drinks shall be served in the secretary's office. Smoking is not allowed in the gymnasium during class exercise. Throwing or putting the shot is prohibited, except under the direction of the physical director. No lofting of balls on bowling alleys will be allowed. 5 cents will be charged to every player for each game played. And finally, the pool charges shall be 2.5 cents per cue for each game. In the very beginning, lockers were provided rent-free to all members of the club. As the membership increased and more lockers were needed, the board of directors deemed it necessary to install a charge for construction and maintenance of this equipment. Double lockers will be rented to individual members for not less than $5 a year. If any two members desire to occupy a double locker together, each shall pay a rental fee of $3.50 per year. If any three members desire to occupy a double locker together, each shall pay the sum of $3 per year. No double locker shall be occupied by more than three members. Single lockers will be rented to individual members for not less than $2.50 per year. If any two members occupy the same single locker, each shall pay $1.75 per year. No single locker shall be used by more than two members. Naturally, one of the first orders of business for the embryo club was quarters ample enough to carry out the provisions and intentions of the charter. Location was important. To grow properly, the club had to be easily accessible to its members, most of whom maintained downtown offices, from which they might be able to walk to the new club and its exercise facilities in a matter of minutes. The committee appointed to settle the matter of housing found what it considered an ideal location at 56 Edgewood Avenue, just down the street from Five Points, the heart of the city. This building was renovated into rather Spartan headquarters, which consisted of administrative offices, a lounge, locker rooms with showers, and a gymnasium with most of the exercise equipment available and modern at that time. Early in its history, AAC was considered primarily a tennis club, and on the vacant lot adjacent to the club building were constructed two of the finest tennis courts in the city, fronting on Edgewood Avenue. It was on these courts that the club began to develop some of its younger players, such athletes as Nate Thornton, C.Y. Smith, E.V. Carter Jr., Frank Owens, and B.M. Grant, whose son Brian Jr., or Bitsy, took over from his dad the job of representing the club and went on to win innumerable honors in tennis, including 10 Southern and 4 National Singles Championships. These and others were to maintain AAC's tennis supremacy over more than 3 decades. The tennis teams had their fun as well as their serious moments of competition. One of Nat Thornton's favorite stories about J.K. Orr and an unusual tennis bet, which probably never came to the attention of the governing board since wagers of any kind were cause for disciplinary measure. Jake Orr, according to Thornton, was a great fellow to play a trick and was a mighty good hand at needling, too. One day he got to jawing back and forth with some of the fellows on the court, who insisted that most of his playing was luck and very little skill. "I can beat any of you guys with my feet tied to a brick," Jake retorted. They settled on a $1 wager, a munificent fund in those days, and somebody brought a brick and a piece of cord to tie it to his foot. "I'll get my own cord," Jake said. He came back with a piece of string about 30 feet long and tied one end to the brick and the other end around his ankle. "In that way," Nate chuckled, "the brick didn't slow him down one bit. He had plenty of space to move around in and won that buck as easy as if the brick hadn't been within a quarter of a mile." In the first clubhouse, there was no telephone and no dining facilities. Only a few months before it moved to its second home on Auburn Avenue, the house committee arranged for what we now call a small snack bar, where soup and sandwiches were available, and in connection with this, a nook from which drinks might be served. Some thought must have been given to mental as well as physical improvement, because from time to time the membership invited prominent people to their interim meetings to talk of various subjects of interest of the day. One of these of record was John Temple Graves, a noted Georgia journalist and lecturer. Apparently, he brought an inspiring message, for he was one of the first honorary members inducted into the club. During the first 3.5 years of its existence, which were spent on Edgewood Avenue, AAC was growing. And there it began to make plans for the giant strides it would take in the future. Possibly the charter member more responsible than any other for the amazing development of the club in those early years was Burton Smith, the Atlanta attorney who drew up the charter, helped to form the general policy, build the membership rolls, and plan for the first of AAC's many moves to more prestigious locations. Smith served as the club's first president and held that office through 5 terms. From 1898 to 1903. He was succeeded by Arnold Broyles, who had a big hand in the creation of the club and its growth in those formative years. Broyles served the first year as a member of the board of directors, then as vice president and Smith's right hand, until he took over the presidency for 2 terms ending in 1905. In that time, under the leadership of those 2 men, the membership of the club grew from 65 to its full complement of 500 resident members, plus 200 non-resident and 5 honorary members, and the great future of AAC began to take shape. Such an expanded membership called for enlarged quarters and more diversified facilities, such as a new clubhouse built to unusual specifications and the first golf course in this section of the country. Other men, whose family names have remained synonymous with Atlanta progress over many scores of years, and who were responsible for the almost unprecedented first strides of AAC, were those who served as the officers and directors through those years between 1898 and 1906. No word of praise is needed for them. Their monument is the foundation on which AAC of today was and is being built. Under this leadership, young AAC was a dynamic organization. During those years, to 1905 to 1906, they built and moved into a new town clubhouse and acquired land for a golf course, which was by now well on its way to completion.